But it just seems strange timing, doesn't it? That all of a sudden, out of nowhere, at the last minute, here comes this allegation. It was used against Clarence Thomas, and it didn't work there. So unless there's some kind of proof, and believe me, I was a criminal investigator, and you can say that there's lots of incidences of crime that unfortunately that are true, that happened, but we can never get the evidence enough to charge anyone. That happens every day in every kind of crime, not just sexual assault crimes. There are things that you just don't have the evidence to prove the crime, and you can't charge anyone. Now, we don't just go around charging people because we believe it happened. All right? Unfortunately, we can't make allegations like that and then just charge people. There has to be facts that you can look at, facts that you can bring to a courtroom. But that's not where our country is now, is it? Our country's not there anymore. We are now in a place where just the allegation of this kind of a thing is enough to destroy you. You're automatically guilty, and everybody better run away from you, because if they don't, they're going to get tagged with it too. So let's be crystal clear here again. See how I keep coming back to this? Because this is America where we live today. You know, I don't know if it happened or not. If it did, it's a horrible thing and it's a crime. If it didn't, that's just as bad for someone to say something like that about someone if it didn't actually happen. Maybe both of them were drinking, and both of them have a little bit of a different memory about how it went. I don't know. I wasn't there, and neither were you. But I know that people who commit sexual assault crimes often repeat it over and over in many different ways. So let's look and see, is there any other allegations against this man of a sexual nature? I'm Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on. This is Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. Welcome to Chasing Justice here on the America Out Loud Radio Network. You know, I got to tell you, some things have come up recently with this nomination of Judge Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court. And I have to say, it seems to me like dirty tricks. I don't know how you could look at it any other way. Here we have, at the very last minute, right before they're supposed to vote, we find yet again someone comes forward with some sexual misconduct allegation at the last minute. Now, I'm not going to say that it didn't happen. I don't know whether it did or not. It was over 30 years ago when apparently the man was in high school when this incident took place. So I'm going to try and look at it in that light. There's a lot of confusion between young people when they're doing the meet the boy, meet the girl ritual. I am not saying that if he did what is alleged, that that is part of that. That would be completely wrong, and that would have been a horrible thing for him to do. All right? Anybody who would drag someone into a room, put their hand over their mouth, and trying to have sex with them is a crime, and that's what is being alleged here. So if that's what happened, then I say that's a criminal act. That's what I don't want to have misconstrued. What I do want to say is let's look at the facts. Apparently there's a letter of 65 different people who know Judge Kavanaugh, apparently people who went to school with him, women who went to school with him back then, who know of no such thing. Never saw any behavior like that, never imagined any behavior like that by him, and they don't know that this is true. Then we have the allegation itself, and this is what I'm talking about in the ritual time. Now, did he actually drag her into a room intoxicated and hold her down and try and have sex with her? Or is this one of those things where people started getting friendly, they ended up in a room together, and it was a little bit of a back and forth? Now, right off the bat, people are gonna, there is no such thing as back and forth. I believe me, I have a wife and I have a daughter, and I've been a law enforcement officer for almost all my adult life, and I understand the difference between unwanted sexual activity, and then we have to say that, you know, there is that back and forth when people are getting comfortable with each other. And, you know, oh, stop, go. And, you know, you can argue this day and night. And in our modern world, we have to pretend that such things really don't exist, when for most people, know that there was always that cat and mouse kind of a game. Once again, I'm not talking about if the man actually dragged this girl into a room, held her down, put his hand over her mouth so she could not scream for help, and tried to disrobe her and have sex with her. That is a crime. Let's be crystal clear. Okay? What I'm saying is the confusion of those kind of encounters, not the criminal kind, but the kind when people are fooling around, going back and forth, maybe it goes too far, you stop, you know, you weren't sure of the signals. I don't know what happened here, but I know we all have been in those kind of positions in our lives. But I want to look at the dirty trick aspect of this. Remember Clarence Thomas? A highly qualified individual for the Supreme Court. And when the left couldn't stop him, all of a sudden came Anita Hill. And she made some allegations of sexual harassment in the workplace. Him using foul language, him saying sexual things to her, a pubic hair on a Coke can. Really? A pubic hair on a Coke can? That is supposed to be somehow sexually enticing to someone? I would think that would be completely disgusting, not sexually enticing. So I don't understand that thing. Now, of course, sexual assault is not about sex. We know that. It's about power, having control and power over someone. But that wasn't proved in any way. It was one person's word against another. And we know, unfortunately, that our friends on the left will lie, will cheat, will make things up. They'll do anything to win. They're not bound by the same ethics as people on the right. They're not worried about it. They're worried about the end result. They're not worried about how they get there. And I can say that with some confidence. In the course of my life, I have seen this over and over again. Okay, another caveat. Yes, conservative people and Republicans do lie as well. Okay, so you can't jump up and down and say, oh, I'm saying that. What I am saying is that overall, we watch our friends in the left lose their minds and go crazy with their responses to all this. In the hearings, when we saw, you know, the senator from New Jersey, Cory Booker, talk about him being Spartacus, how ridiculous. We have these people screaming and hollering in the gallery. We know that they were paid for by Democratic operatives. We know that they were sent there to do that. We know that there's been conversations about doing those things on the left, because that's how they operate. All right, we can say no, they don't, and Republicans do too, but that's not the case that you're looking at right now. If there's a Democrat president and the Republicans do that kind of nonsense, I would say the same thing. It's ridiculous. I was surprised when I heard the other day that Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg came out and said she thought it was horrible that Justice Scalia was 98 to nothing, I think, was his approval, and hers was similarly high, and she said this was not a good thing, what was going on. I was honestly surprised by that. I don't know if many people know it, but Judge Scalia is ultra-conservative, and Judge Ginsburg, ultra-liberal. They were actually friends. They went out to dinner together. They spoke together highly. Amazing. People on the left and the right can actually get along and have conversations. But to go back to my point is that this last-minute allegation by this woman that apparently Senator Feinstein knew about for a long time, had this letter, wherever this letter came from, but didn't bring it up in any of the meetings that they had about this, in the classified meetings, the unclassified meetings, the public meetings, the closed-door meetings. She never brought this up. Until the week before, or the week of the vote. Now all of a sudden, now that we have this allegation, we have to stop. We can't go on any further with this. It's a stalling tactic. If this is something that happened 30-something years ago, Was it reported then? Was there a criminal investigation? Why are we looking at this 30 years later when apparently there is no other instance we can find in this man's life of this type of behavior? We even have those 65 women who knew him then, and apparently they're from different political backgrounds, saying they've never seen anything like this from this guy. So was this a one-off instance between him and this young woman? If they even had the encounter at all, we don't know. It's his word against her word. We don't know. I'm not saying she's wrong, but he's saying it never happened. And what kind of evidence are we going to have 30 years later from a high school party where people were drinking? And that is going to determine someone's life some 30 years later after a brilliant career, that all of a sudden an allegation is enough to derail this man's opportunity to go to the Supreme Court? Seems very convenient, doesn't it, that this came up? That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that it didn't happen. And if it did, it was a horrible and despicable thing. And I wished it was handled 30 years ago. We wouldn't be here today. But what evidence are we going to get today? We're going to get a multitude of Democrat senators jumping up and down screaming, he's a rapist, he's a horrible man, he's an animal, he's a anti-woman. That's what they're going to do. They're going to grandstand this. They're going to take the allegation as absolute fact, and they're going to go after the story that this young lady brought up. Now, apparently, initially said she would not come forward. She didn't want to come forward, and that was that. So why write the letter in the first place? Why write such a letter to a senator if you're not going to come forward? Well, I've had a lot of people ask that question, and I think I have a reasonable response why that would happen. If this is something that happened to you, and you see, now this man's going for the Supreme Court, maybe you don't want to come forward and testify and sit there and be torn apart, which is what's going to happen when this woman comes forward. So maybe, but you just maybe wanted them to know about it. Hey, just so you know, I know the guy, and this is something he did to me. You should be aware of it. Maybe that's what she was doing. I give her the benefit of the doubt there. Maybe she wrote that letter, just wanted to let her senator know she had information about the guy, her own personal experience, but she wasn't willing to come forward. Maybe the senator could do something with it, do some other investigation, but the parent victim was not going to come forward. Now we see over the weekend that not only has she gone from anonymity, she's now been named, and now she is going to come forward. And she's going to say some, I wonder what happened in the time since she wrote that letter months ago and said she was not going to come forward to now, when it looks like we're just going to move ahead because there's no evidence to prove that any of this happened. So, you know, I got to say, I'm uncomfortable sitting here talking about this topic to show you how our nation has gone, that just the sheer allegation against somebody is enough to convict them now, because I'm uncomfortable even bringing up the fact that maybe it didn't happen. Oh my gosh, what are people going to think about me that I think there's an allegation made? It has to be absolutely true. Well, unfortunately, in the real world, that's not how it works. You can ask any cop, any detective, that there are lots and lots of allegations made against people, including sexual assault allegations, that turn out to not be true. You know, a sexual assault allegation is a very powerful thing to throw up against somebody. You know, nobody wants to be involved with someone who has committed a sexual assault. That's a terrible thing. That's why it has such power. And we know that people do use it as a weapon against people sometimes. I don't know if this woman's doing that or not. But it just seems strange timing, doesn't it? That all of a sudden, out of nowhere, at the last minute, here comes this allegation. It was used against Clarence Thomas, and it didn't work there. So unless there's some kind of proof, and believe me, I was a criminal investigator, and you can say that there's lots of incidences of crime that unfortunately that are true, that happened, but we can never get the evidence enough to charge anyone. That happens every day in every kind of crime, not just sexual assault crimes. There are things that you just don't have the evidence to prove the crime, and you can't charge anyone. Now, we don't just go around charging people because we believe it happened. All right? Unfortunately, you know, we can't make allegations like that and then just charge people. There has to be facts that you can look at, facts that you can bring to a courtroom. But that's not where our country is now, is it? Our country's not there anymore. We are now in a place where just the allegation of this kind of a thing is enough to destroy you. You're automatically guilty, and everybody better run away from you, because if they don't, they're going to get tagged with it too. So let's be crystal clear here again. See how I keep coming back to this? Because this is America where we live today. You know, I don't know if it happened or not. If it did, it's a horrible thing and it's a crime. If it didn't, that's just as bad for someone to say something like that about someone if it didn't actually happen. Maybe both of them were drinking, and both of them have a little bit of a different memory about how it went. I don't know. I wasn't there, and neither were you. But I know that people who commit sexual assault crimes often repeat it over and over in many different ways. So let's look and see, is there any other allegations against this man of a sexual nature? There are none at all. So that tells me one of two things. One, either he had a very bad night where he allowed himself to do something to this girl, whether it be because of alcohol or not, doesn't matter. He shouldn't have done it if he did it. And if he did, it was a crime 30 years ago. But maybe it wasn't exactly the way it's being reported. Maybe this woman's story has been manipulated. Maybe the woman's been manipulated. I don't know. It's just awful strange that it comes out right before the vote on whether or not this man's going to join the court. And you see how panicked the Democrats are. And a lot of the people who are followers of that kind of thinking. They think, you know, he's going to get on the court and take away Roe versus Wade, even though he's testified that he believes that that's precedent-setting law, and he wouldn't necessarily do that. I don't know. He might not. Because you know what? New cases come up in front of the court all the time. So who knows? Maybe he would. Maybe he wouldn't. But they are so afraid of it that just like with the Clarence Thomas case and many other people, at the last minute, there's a sexual assault allegation. You know? Think about it. Doesn't it seem just a little too convenient? Just a little too convenient, I think. So those are my thoughts on that right there. You know, in a couple of minutes, we're gonna go over to Clancy's with the fellas and the ladies in the neighborhood, and we're going to talk about what's going on over there with them. But, you know, I hope that if this really did happen, that this woman finds satisfaction, and if it didn't, then I hope it gets cleared very quickly so we can move on with our country. All right. At the end, in our third segment today, we're going to hear an interview with Michelle Gay. Now, this is the beginning of the school year across the country, and school security is big, and you know I talk about that a lot. That's what I do. It's my passion. It's what I write about. It's what I go out and I try and help schools with. But we have Michelle Gay on as an interview. Michelle is the founding member of an organization that worries about schools, Safe and Sound Schools. Michelle is also the mom of Josephine Gay, who was killed in the Sandy Hook school shooting attack. I got to know Michelle when she was on a speaking tour. We've written some articles together, and she is an amazing, amazing person. She has taken the tragedy of what happened to her family, and she's turned it into something, trying to be positive to help other people keep school safe. So we have an interview with her that will be in the segment number three. Very interesting. I think you're really going to enjoy it. All right, so thanks for being here. You know, I really enjoy my time here on Chasing Justice, and it's very serious topics this week. So I'm glad that we get this time together. So go out and take a look at our sponsors, right? MCON IT, which is MCONIT.com. They are third-party data recovery people, keep your data safe and secure. The Blue Magazine, www.thebluemagazine.com. It's a magazine for law enforcement, for men and women across the country. It's a great magazine. I think you'll really enjoy it. My company, True Security Design. You can find us at truesecuritydesign.com or jpangaro.com. You can find our information out there. All right, so thank you. I appreciate it very much for listening to our station here, listening to America Out Loud. It's one of the few places where you can hear free speech exactly as it comes out. All right, so we'll be back in a couple minutes with round two, and we're heading over to Clancy's with the neighborhood crew.
I'd like you to meet Dr. Bev, psychotherapist, grandmother, podcast, and talk radio host of Emotions Are Us on America Out Loud. You've seen a lot in your years in private practice. What is the one obstacle that people fear the most?
Asking for help in the midst of a crisis. Having the courage to call a professional when they don't know what to do, how to do.
Dr. Bev, we've seen a rise in street violence in cities everywhere around the world. What can we do to change this trajectory to keep our family and loved ones safe?
Make time to talk. Make time to encourage each other and listen. Listen. Don't judge. Listen.
Yeah, well said. Sometimes we don't do enough listening. Speaking of which, when we say on America Out Loud, let the silent voices be heard, how can we turn the tide of ignorance in the world today?
Stop listening to the fake news. Think for yourself. Actions. Actions speak louder than words. Follow the connected dots. If it acts like a duck, walk like a duck, it is a duck.
Well, with all the fake news and bad information out there, we call ourselves the alternative news choice. America Out Loud. Welcome to the new era in communications.
All right, everybody. Welcome to round two here on Chasing Justice. We have the neighborhood, and we are back at Clancy's Tavern in Neptune, New Jersey. I want to thank Clancy's Tavern. They're excellent. They've allowed us to come in here. The food is great, the drink is great, and the location is outstanding. The rooms are beautiful. Jack, you've been here before. What do you think about Clancy's, Jack?
To pull up in front of Clancy's is deceiving. To come inside, to see how big, how clean, how nice the place is, and then to enjoy the atmosphere. It's really an exceptional place to come and spend your time.
You're right, because you know what? It's a storefront, right? It's a bunch of shops.
It's just a storefront, and it's very deceiving, as I said. But to come in here and to see the atmosphere, the people, the service is outstanding. Just to come in here, not as a Chasing Justice player, but to come in just as a person off the street. It's always been exceptional service here. The drinks are great. And as Joe stated, the food is really outstanding.
Yes, we've had a lot of our PBA events here, and they're always friendly. They take very good care of us. So anybody out there that's listening on the Jersey Shore, you know, make sure you stop into Clancy's. We can't thank them enough for supporting Chasing Justice and supporting law enforcement, the men and women, first responders of police work, fire departments, first aid, EMTs, as well as our brother and sisters in the military who do everything to keep us all safe. So remember, come on down to Clancy's. All right, so here we are in the neighborhood, and we can't help but talk about some of the things that are going on with school safety and security. Now, you know my business, True Security, Pangaro Training, that is what I focus on. We keep schools safe and secure and all of that. And today we have a special guest here. We have Todd Jr. Todd Pangaro Jr. is here. Todd just graduated high school, and I wanted to ask him his impressions because we have to listen to the kids. We have to listen to them because as much as we make rules and we come up with all this stuff to keep them safe, how they feel is very important. So Todd, welcome aboard.
Thanks for having me, Uncle Joe.
That's great. So how do you think, what do you feel about school security? What did you see? What do you think when you were going to school?
When I was going to school, I was getting,
Did you feel, when you were attending the school, mm-hmm. did you feel that anybody could just come in from the parking lot into your school?
Yes.
And or enter your classroom?
Yes, I feel that, yes.
And you didn't like that, did you?
No, I didn't.
Right. Did they ask you kids, did they train you what to do? Did they give you lockdown drills
yes,
and stuff?
Yes, they give me lockdown drills, and then a couple times during the course of the school year, we had a couple shelter in place.
Oh, you did?
Because we were getting threats from outside of the school.
Did you ever have the police come in and work with you guys? Did the police ever come in?
Police were there 24/7.
They were there all the time? Well, that was good. At least that's a good thing. You know you have the cops there.
How many officers were present in your school at any one time that you know of? That were visible to you. How many do you think were there at any one time? Were there four guys to cover four doorways, or were there eight guys to cover two doorways? How many do you believe were in your school at any time?
kind of hard to say, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a little hard to say.
What was the most you saw at one time?
Two cop cars with like either like two or three.
Oh, so that's pretty good coverage that you had there. Yeah. So, Jim, welcome back. Jim the Contrarian is here. He must have stepped out here at Clancy's to get something to eat or something to drink, or God knows who he was talking at the bar. Jim, we're talking about school security right now, and obviously we've seen some incidents already that have taken place. Now, there's been no active shooter in a building, but we have had there was a shooting just recently where a guy shot some people in the parking lot of a school, and out in Colorado there was an incident where there was a shooting in the parking lot, and it looked like it might have been gang-related, where people were shooting each other. So those, like I said, aren't necessarily school shootings as active shooters. They took place on school property. But we have to be prepared. We have to look forward. Now, Donna, back in the day in law enforcement, when you and I were on the job, at the end of my career, there was a big concern about active shooters everywhere.
Definitely.
But going back 25 years ago, 30 years ago, we didn't really have that, did we?
Not to my recollection. And training is not as proactive as it is now.
Right.
For law enforcement.
It absolutely is. And that's one of the things that's really great. The problem that we have, and you might be having that out there in Chasing Justice Land, is that your local police might be very good at what they do, but they really don't work with your schools. The schools and the cops, to this day, in many places, still have a big problem getting together. For whatever reason, whether the police don't feel comfortable in the schools, or the schools don't like having the cops there, whatever it is, we have to overcome that. Because the reality is, if you don't get together with your local police, have them do walkthroughs on a regular basis, park the car out front to write their reports, when something bad happens, the cops are not going to know where to go. So one of the things that we've been doing here as part of this series is that we talk about what can schools do. Now, I say that, you know, numbering your exterior doors and labeling your building is so important, because unless your police officers spend a lot of time in your building, if they get a call, they're shooting in the science wing, they're going to have no idea where the science wing of your school is. They're going to roll up to the front door like everybody else does, and they're going to be saying, where's the science wing? So what you do is you label the exterior of your building, A, B, C, and D sides, all right? And then you individually number the doors. Some people also put the classroom numbers in the bottom corner of the window. Two thoughts on that. People say, oh my gosh, you know, if somebody wants to get you and they know you're in room 231, they can shoot through the window and kill you. Like we said many times, lots of things could happen. Has that ever happened? It has not. But what it could happen, if we could say the shooting is in room 231, the cops can ride up, they see side A, 231, they know that's where the shooter is. Time equals life. The quicker we get our cops there, or we get our security guns to be able to focus on the danger, the better off we're going to be. So this is one of the things I talk about. And when I say the ABCD, when you look at the building, every door on the front, everything on the front is the A side. Everything to the left is the B side. Everything in the back is C side. And everything on the right is the D side. And then you individually number the doors sequentially. A1, A2, A3, B4, B5, B6, C7, C8, and you go on and on. You put those numbers up there at least 6 inches tall. Nice background so you can see the number clearly, because that's where your cops want to go. All your cameras, if you have cameras, your cameras, when they look out towards the field from the building, there should be some kind of a sign there that says this is the camera next to door D5, so that people know when they're looking at the camera where this is taking place. All of this is important. You know, all of us have had kids in school. I still have, you know, children in school and college and in high school, and it is a concern. I asked my son this morning, and I said, hey, have they done anything? And he says, actually, they have. People can't just walk in the front door anymore. They have to be buzzed in, so we get a few minutes to see who's at that door before they attack it. Anybody got any thoughts you want to pass on?
I think all that is great, Joe, and it's necessary, but it's all reactive. We have to be proactive, and proactive has to come in many fashions. One is monitoring the internet. And the problem I see is, where does this monitoring become an infringement of rights?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And it's one of the same problem I have with the NSA. I mean, I think monitoring the internet is important. And what the thing that strikes me the most is the most recent shootings. And I do believe in the Second Amendment. The most recent shootings I've seen, people had guns that have no business having guns.
Correct.
They are on psychotropic drugs. I mean, how do they get, if there was a mechanism to screen people, it's failing. And there's got to be a way to do it to make it work.
With our gun control policies getting more and more strict, I think there should be a lot more information available. You can trust your children implicitly, but you can't leave a gun laying around, regardless of who they are. You need a gun safe. You need trigger locks or what have you. Nobody inside your home should have access to that gun.
Some of these recent shootings, there were younger people who actually bought guns. They went through a supposed background check. And, you know, it's a joke, these background checks.
Well, I can buy a fishing pole, okay? But I can't do anything with it in fresh water without a license. I shouldn't be able to buy a gun without a safe.
Well, here's the point. What you're talking about is reasonable gun control. We have a Second Amendment for a purpose, and it's not to go hunting and shoot a deer, as our governor in New York likes to say. It is there for self-protection. It is there to thwart a government that wants to take your rights. Now, we can have the argument that we're not going to fight against tanks and military. We've had that before, but the reality is that's the purpose of the Second Amendment. But can we have some common sense things? I'm not opposed to that. A gun safe? There's gun safes now you can get that operate on biometrics, that only the person with the fingerprints on the gun safe can open it. Now you can designate, me and my wife should be able to get to that gun in an emergency. You put your hand on it, the safe opens up, there's the gun ready to go, but your 9-year-old can't pull it out and accidentally shoot his friend. We know statistically that these kids that do these shootings, the majority of them get the guns that they stole or took from a relative or a friend's house. So your point, Jack, is exactly right. These guns got to be locked up somewhere. You know, I remember when I was a kid going to a friend's house, and he says to me, hey, you want to see my father's gun? And now we were probably 12 years old. We had guns at that age. We went BB gun shooting, 22 shooting. So it wasn't that big of a deal, but the guns were accessible. It was a crazy thing. There was a kid in, he was a couple of years older than me, and I've prayed for this kid ever since I was a little kid. Him and his friend skipped school, and they were at home, and one boy was showing his friend his father's gun. It was a 38, and it was loaded, and he was showing it to him, and he put it back in his father's closet. Well, about 10 minutes later, the boy whose house it was went to the bathroom, and the other kid went back in the bedroom, took the gun out again, and was looking at it, and when the boy walked in the room, said, what are you doing? The kid pulled the trigger and shot and killed him in his own home with his father's gun. I have never forgotten that. As a young person, that frightened me. And we had guns in my house. My father had guns. I went hunting. It wasn't something, I was afraid of guns. I couldn't believe that could happen accidentally. And these are the kind of things that we're talking about. So these school shooting kids, they take these guns from home. Lock up your guns. Make sure you know where they are. Jim, to your point, mental illness. In America, we do not deal with mental illness. It is a taboo. Other places might deal with it better, I couldn't tell you. But here in America, who goes to get help? Who wants to take their kid to go get help? Because, oh my God, somebody will say something about them. And we've made it such a terrible thing that nobody goes for the help.
Or we put a soft label on that mental illness so that it doesn't sound offensive or nobody is defensive about it. And it's not my kid. And as far as what we were discussing, unfortunately, we can't get into it here or now, but it comes down to the parent. Guns were present in his home. Guns were present in my home. To this day, my father has passed on, but he taught me when I was a child, if you disassembled a gun and handed me the barrel, I still couldn't point it at anyone. The way my father taught me, I couldn't point a gun at anybody, not even a cap pistol. I couldn't and I wouldn't. And that is the training that I received and everyone should receive.
I think that's fantastic. Donna, I want to take a minute here in the neighborhood, and this is good. We talked about the school security, but you brought something up last week when we had you here on the neighborhood. You have a book coming out. And what is the name of your book?
Battered Blue.
battered blue. Now, I got to tell you, Chasing Justice people, all my law enforcement friends out there, everybody's going to want to get this book. It is so much of a story. I don't want to tell Donna's story, but I'm just going to give you some background. Donna's personal story, which is this book.
It's a memoir, yes.
It's a memoir of Donna's personal book. Donna's a law enforcement officer. She was tough as nails. She still is. She was a cop. She rose to the rank of captain. And Donna suffered, as her family suffered, with domestic violence. And I think that is the essence of this book, Battered Blue, and it's her story. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it, Donna? And when it comes out, everybody should get it because it's an amazing story.
Well, thank you, Joe. My father was in law enforcement. He was a peace officer, constable with the Sheriff's Department. And he served in World War II and was his ship was hit and he went into the shark-infested Pacific waters. He was carrying a lot of biological damage from domestic violence in his own home setting and post-war. Unbeknownst to my mother, when they married, when he was stateside in the hospital recovering, the monster that lay within. So for more than 35 years, I was exposed to, as a bystander witness and as a victim survivor, to horrific acts of physical battering and emotional degradation and all the things that go along with that. And in the book, I relate the memoir in some ways to what's going on in our country today, that the problems that were once considered by society to be hidden home secrets, like domestic violence, produce children like me. Children that are prone to wanting to perpetrate acts of violence, that enjoy seeing violence perpetrated. And it's not easy to divulge this to your audience, but in a memoir you have to be truthful to yourself and transparent as well. So the book is a journey of my mother's journey along with mine. Although I have two siblings, I've excluded them from being in the book for personal reasons. And so it's every child's nightmare to live what I went through, but it's the lessons learned by me and how I applied those lessons to serving the public. And I think one of the most important parts of what I've learned is that you can't keep violence hidden. And if your child is presenting with red flags, or the school identifies some red flags in your child, propensity to instigate violence, to watch violence, to talk about violence, to plan violence, it's percolating in the home setting usually. It's what a child sees and accepts for normalcy is how their life's journey will be, unless there is an intervention or proactiveness. So
well,
thank
Donna,
you for
I gotta say, that was an outstanding segue from your story into what we've been talking about, school violence. Now, I have about a minute left. Now, I don't know if you want to give away probably the most powerful scene I know you've revealed to me from that story. I don't know if you want to talk about it, you want people to read the book, where you had a confrontation as a law enforcement officer and you came very close to going over the edge.
Yes, my father and mother had an argument, and I was a law enforcement officer. I was coming home from a day class at college. I walked into the kitchen, and my mother had a cleaver in her hand, and she was advancing towards my father. I interceded, knocked the cleaver out of her hand, and my father picked me up by my chin and put me on the kitchen table, straddled me, and began to strangle me to death. And it was, to this day, I believe, God's hand that saved me and my mother from a near fatal incident.
Thank you, Donna. And this is a very real, very powerful story of domestic violence. I'm not going to tell you how that confrontation came out, but you just picture that scene listening to Donna from Newark. All right? And you can imagine how things went after that. But I'll tell you right now, my friends, when that comes out, we'll have Donna back on and we will talk about that book, Battered Blue. You have to get it and go look at blueforcefilms.com. Now listen, we've had another great episode here in the neighborhood. I want to thank everybody. I want to thank Todd Jr. for coming in and sitting in here with us. Todd, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
It's excellent. Remember, look at our sponsors out there. We have my company, True Security Design, Pangaro Training. We have MCON IT, thebluemagazine.com. And we also want to thank A-Plus Technology and Security, A-PlusTechnology.com. I want to thank everybody in the neighborhood for being here.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Thrilled today to have a tremendous person with us today, Ms. Michelle Gay. Michelle is the executive director and co-founder of Safe and Sound Schools, which is dedicated to helping all of us keep our kids safe. Michelle is also the mom of Josephine Gay. Josephine was one of the children that were killed in the horrific attack on the Sandy Hook school. And Michelle, I thank you so much for coming on to help everybody make the kids safer. So welcome aboard.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's fantastic. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your organization, how it came to be, and what you do? Because I know you do a lot of tremendous things for people in schools.
Thank you. So Safe and Sound Schools is obviously born out of our very personal, tragic loss at Sandy Hook School. I'm joined by another mother, Alyssa Parker, who lost her daughter, Emily, that same day. Joey and Emily were dear friends and classmates, and they had a lot in common. Although I didn't know the Parker family, Emily's family, before the tragedy, apparently our two girls had quite a connection and were both very positive, welcoming, friendly little forces of nature in their class and in the school community. So Alyssa and I really took our cue from the girls, you know, when looking to build their legacies. And for us, being moms, having surviving children, I have two other daughters, one of whom survived in the building that day, another that was in a different school building. You know, we had to send our surviving kids back to school, and that was hard. You know,
that was
hard. And I know it wasn't just me. It was folks around the country, parents around the country, grandparents thinking, is it safe or can we do this? And for me, I knew we had to do it. I knew from my girls that it was important that we do it. But I really needed help to be able to do it. So we started reaching out to people in law enforcement and mental health and in education, leaders around the country. We started tapping into the experts out there in safety and security. And what we found was a wealth of knowledge that somehow, despite all the tragedies we've suffered throughout our history as a country, particularly school-based tragedies, that knowledge just wasn't making its way to the boots on the ground, the parents, the teachers, the students, and that really struck us. So that's become our mission, to ensure that every school has the tools and resources that they need to ensure school safety from prevention through recovery. So that's us at Safe and Sound Schools.
That's fantastic. And I remember when I first met you, I was still in law enforcement, and you were doing a talking place in New Jersey, and I went to see it, and I was so moved by your story that I have to tell you, it changed the way I did things. I studied what happened at Sandy Hook, and there are so many lessons there that can help people that I started to take them as best as I could and try and make a plan out of them. Here's what we learned, and every one of these incidents, which, you know, unfortunately, we know there's been some since then, we want to prevent the next ones. But in each thing like this, there's lessons that can be learned, you know, just about how to secure the buildings, the glass, the doors, you know, the poor teachers having to go in the hallway to lock their doors. And that still happens in so many places. It's amazing. There are solutions out there. And I took that from as best as I could from your story. You moved me so much that it became my passion. And that's when I started teaching school safety and security. And then when I retired, I incorporated it into my business for training and going out there. And now I'm doing threat assessments all over the country, basically. And I share your passion to keep kids safe. I still have kids in school myself. And my son's in high school, and I drop him off, and he walks away from the car, and I'm hoping that the day is going to go well.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we're still living in an uncertain world, and, you know, I have those conversations. My girls are both in high school now, and we have those conversations pretty regularly, but we're having those conversations, and I think that's important. It's not just looking at how we can make the school building and the facilities safer, and there are a lot of things we can do there. But there's a tremendous amount that we can do to just better educate and prepare students, teachers, and parents so that we are as prepared as we possibly can be to get to safety, to keep our areas safe, regardless of what the circumstances might be.
You're right. And some of the things that I talk about that I would get your opinion on is that it's nice to have all the hardware and the equipment. That's one piece of it. But it's the internal threats that we have to look at, not just the external threat. Now at Sandy Hook, it was an external threat, and that equipment and that training can certainly help us there. But I try and break it down to internal and external and look at what can we – people that are violent like that don't just pop up on a Tuesday and decide to go hurt people. No. There are signs of potential problems before the violence erupts, and teaching the teachers what to look for, the administrators – you know, the things the kids draw, the things they say, they write, the parents, what are your kids saying at home? What are you hearing? We all have to be a part of that. Do you agree with that?
I definitely do. And I think I have to say that as a culture, as a nation, we've really made tremendous progress over the last decade with the See Something, Say Something campaign. That has really kind of changed the way people think, and I think empowered them to speak up. I think where we see the real pitfall is that people are reporting, as we saw in the community of Parkland, people are reporting, and then if there is no mechanism, no infrastructure for the follow through, for intervention, for monitoring, for management of those threats and concerns that citizens, students, teachers, parents might bring up, then we're really not much better off than we were in the first place. So it's really more than just, you know, say something. It's really about, is there something in place? Have we worked together as a community to make sure that we can really do something? Because as you mentioned, in our case, and as well in the case in Parkland, and sadly, almost all of these cases, there are warning signs and people are speaking up, but if they're not sharing information, if there is not a collaborative, multidisciplinary team that is assessing and constantly evaluating and looking back and monitoring these situations, then tragedy, unfortunately, is inevitable.
I agree, and they say it falls through the cracks. I don't find that to be a good answer. You know, and we look at Parkland and you see they had just about everything you could have in place, even a police officer, and it still didn't help because they missed the signs. You know, I think one of the areas as a society we really need to consider is we still can't talk about the mental health issues. It's a taboo. We can't talk about it. We don't bring it up. But as a society, we're going to have to make some decisions that, you know, how do we maintain civil liberties? But at the same time, you have a person who's saying things like this and they have access to weapons. And I'm not an anti-weapon person. I'm a police officer and I get that. But you have to have common sense things. If people have mental problems, they're making threats, they're saying they're going to do terrible things, that person can't have a weapon. We have to, you know, remove that. But how do we do that within our constitutional boundaries? That's the law enforcement side of me.
Sure. And I think, you know, still talking about this particular case in Parkland at the high school, this is an example of a situation where people were seeing the signs, they were reporting the signs, but there wasn't that infrastructure, there wasn't that mechanism to intervene and to stay with that person so that person could be safe, himself as well as the community. He was a danger to himself and the community. And in those cases, there is already legislation in place to provide protection for that person and for that community. So I think we can certainly look at how we shore that up, how we strengthen our capabilities there. But I still think it really comes down to where is that information? Where are those tips? Where are those concerns? Where are they funneling? And who is owning them? Who is following it? Who is making sure that the family is getting the interventions they need, that there is, that there are social services and supports provided to an individual or a family, as well as letting that school community know, you know, you have this risk here. And so you need to make sure that your school, your building, the people, the place, and the practices are all as sound as they can be, so that if God forbid this erupts into something, you are prepared to keep everyone safe.
I agree. And when I look at that, I say on the law enforcement side, we have a narcotic problem, so we have a narcotic division. We have a vice problem, we have a vice division. There needs to be something specialized specifically for this. Now, I know they have resource officers, and that's good. It's usually cops in the school, you know, talking to the kids. But a unit within the PD that follows up on this. I mean, and also in the schools. I know as a school security director, when you look out there, there's probably only about 39% of school districts in the country that have a full-time school security director, someone to look at security as their job, as opposed to some administrator that has everything else to do. So I think you're right about that. We need to focus our society on this is important, and here is a real answer to these things. A police division or a couple detectives, just like a task force, that are set up to pay attention to that and follow up on those investigations.
So I like the word you said, task force. I like those words because we are proponents for threat assessment and management teams in school communities and in the greater communities as well, because we want to see that there are dedicated professionals in law enforcement, in mental health, in the schoolhouse, and out in the community that are available when these concerns come up to be looking at these things from all angles, to be tapping into the resources and connections that they all uniquely have because of their discipline or their profession, and making sure that those channels of communication are open and continual so that we can stay on top of these things.
I think that's outstanding, and I think together we've come up with some solutions here. Now, why don't you tell us real quickly a couple of the programs that your organization is running and how can people contact you?
Yeah, for us, a lot of it is about, I'm a teacher, right? I'm always gonna identify as a teacher. So if for me, you know, education, knowledge is power. That's how we have solved some of the greatest societal problems, you know, that we've ever faced in as a civilization. So for us, a lot of it has to do with making sure that parents, that teachers, that students have the resources that they need, the education that they need to be able to really engage and become a part of school safety. So it's not just the police job anymore. It's not just
all of our jobs.
Yeah, we got to be all hands on deck here in terms of school safety and community safety. So, you know, we have parents, we have a parent program coming out, Parents for Safer Schools. Right now you can kind of get a sneak peek at it on our website, safeandsoundschools.org, to just kind of explore what it's growing into. We also have a student program, Safe and Sound Youth Council program, designed to allow students to step up in a leadership role, to really be a part of and learn about public safety and school safety through service projects, annual service projects. We have our Straight A Safety toolkits and program that they've been out there and growing for several years now. We get a lot of engagement and a lot of interest from those, and many more are in the final stages of development and ready for release this school year. So we encourage folks to check us out, check back often, and to join us, become a part of our national community.
So safeandsoundschools.org.
Got it.
All right, so everybody out there that's watching, this is important. That's why we're here, right? This is the School Safety and Security Show. Go to safeandsoundschools.org, see what Michelle and her organization have to offer. Let's all make our schools safer. Michelle, I want to take a second and tell you, I really appreciate you coming on. I know we've written an article in the past together, and it was really well received. Your voice is important. You're a tremendous advocate for school safety and security, and this is great to have you here. You know, I think maybe in the future, if I could get you to come back, maybe we could talk about recovery from an event. I think you lived through that community. What happened? Right. I think we could talk about that.
Important aspect of school safety. Absolutely. That's why our mission is prevention through recovery. So I will look forward to that, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you very much. And you know what? Josephine, very proud of her mom.
Thank you. I hope so.
Thank you, everybody. And thank you, Michelle. We'll see you next week. Remember, we're all part of the solution here. See you then.